Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, coming to you each and every Sunday afternoon from 4 to 5 here on News Talk 580 KMJ. It's December 16th, 2007, and I mention the date because today it's important. Today marks the 63rd anniversary of the opening of the Battle of the Bulge, a battle that would wear on for weeks, become the bloodiest that Americans participated in World War II, and it was a surprise attack by German forces at 5:30 in the morning in a frozen forest called the Ardennes. And our guest today was there on December 16th, 1944. Frank Creed joins us, and Your Honor, if I can call you that. He is a judge. In fact, if you go to downtown Fresno and you look at the law library in the Fresno County Courthouse, you'll see a nice bronze bust of Judge Creed there. They did a good job on that, too. Does your wife think it looks like you?
Well, they, Ed Marouk, is a sculptor and a retired attorney, and he did the bust, and he was very meticulous, and I think he did an outstanding job.
Of course, if he had caught you in the early months of 1945, it would have been a much more slender bust, because...
Well, between the time he started and when I when it was finished, I had lost 30 pounds, literally. So, and he had to redo the portion of the head so that to reflect my present
Well, the bust looks good, and you look good, but long before you became a judge, long before that was named after you in downtown Fresno, you were growing up in San Francisco. Your father was a prominent lawyer there in San Francisco, but that didn't mean that you were exempt from serving our country, you ended up in the Army.
My father was on the draft appeals board, and we had a very short conversation. He said... When I became 18, he said, "You know, there's nothing I can do to keep you out of the service. There's nothing I would do if I could, and you wouldn't want me to." And I said, "That's right." So then, about 9 months later, they got an MIA notice.
And maybe he felt differently about what he had said to you at that
point. Well, I don't think so, but my mother certainly suffered more than I did, because she didn't know whether I was dead or alive for about 3 months.
And we'll get to why he was MIA and why they didn't know if he was dead or alive. But before we even get to the Battle of the Bulge, I often enjoy, when I visit with veterans, as I've been doing for the last few years, hearing the stories about when they first got in, because you go in as an impressionable teenager not knowing what to expect, and you're faced with all these experiences even before you get overseas that are real eye-openers. And the one thing that I hear from a lot of veterans who ended up particularly at Camp Roberts, the 25-mile hike.
That's right. And I made it on a 103-degree day. And so when you... they tell you the day will come that you wish you were back at Camp Roberts. I thought at that time that day could never come, but it did.
It did, for sure. And it wasn't long after the date that I just mentioned. December 16th was when the Battle of the Bulge began. Describe for me, if you can, the time leading up to that. And obviously I'm jumping ahead a little bit here, because you're in the Army, you end up overseas, you're with the 106th Infantry Division, the Golden Lions. And I know that they had told you at that time, even though you're freezing your rear end off in the Ardennes, because it was the most brutal winter that continent had seen in quite some time, you didn't expect to see a whole lot of action there, did you?
No, they said it was a quiet sector, and and outside of patrol activity, no heavy engagements are anticipated. Well, American intelligence was up to its usual excellence.
He said sarcastically, with tongue firmly planted in cheek.
Sure, but the day did come when Camp Roberts would have looked pretty good, even after a 25-mile hike.
What were your duties there in Europe with the 106th Division?
I was in the heavy weapons or machine gun squad, and my duties were, I was an ammunition bearer. My duties were to get the ammunition from the jeep to the gun without getting shot.
Easier said than done.
That's right.
Especially if you're running through snow.
Well, that's right.
So you were told it was a quiet front. You didn't expect to see a whole lot of action.
It's a good place to break into combat. There hasn't been any heavy engagements in the Schnee-Eifel Mountains of the Ardennes Forest since September '44, and they didn't anticipate any heavy engagements outside of patrol activity. So
you're a 19-year-old just over there having fun as long as you can stay warm, right?
And stay alive, yes. but staying warm was the biggest challenge. But one thing the American Army had is heavy wool overcoats, and all of our clothing was wool and good quality and it dated to keep us warm.
For me, if you can, that morning, December 16th, I imagine that the attack coming at 5:30 in the morning was a pretty significant wake-up call for you, and a pretty thunderous wake-up call.
Well, there is thunderous artillery,
Is that the first thing you remember that morning, is the sound of German artillery?
Artillery, yes, because they had always had periodic episodes of artillery. In fact, in one instance, I saw the German 88 gunners try to hit a single man running across a field, and they didn't get him, but they came awfully close.
You have to feel for that guy.
That's right.
Talking about getting a fly with a sledgehammer.
That's right.
Yikes.
Well, they were doing it. They wanted to keep in practice, and the 88 was the best artillery weapon of the war or of any war recently.
Were you caught by surprise that morning? Did it seem like a panic to you when that artillery barrage opened up? Were you guys ready to respond?
No one was in panic because they had periodically hit us in the forest, in the Ardennes Forest, but nothing quite like the opening on December 16th. It was surprising that it was that intense, but then after an hour it dropped off. And then our battalion was in reserve in a town called Bourne, Belgium. So we weren't right up on the front line when it started, but they quickly moved us up from Bourne to just outside of Schoenberg, which is on the Auer River, and that's the border between Belgium and Germany.
Mm-hmm.
By that, we certainly did not anticipate it, such a massive offensive, and were surprised by the extent of it.
Well, and there was another surprise to come just a couple of days later for Frank Creed, then 19, in the freezing forest in Europe in 1944. We'll get to that surprise and what the next couple years of his life would be like, at least 1945. Right now, we'll take a commercial break. We'll come back with more with Judge Frank Creed. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. I'm your host, Paul Leffler, joined today by Judge Frank J. Creed, Jr. You may have been in his courtroom once upon a time. I hope it was for a good reason, if you were. And we're glad to have him on the program today. We were talking beforehand about his experience in the military at the start of World War II, or at least the start of the war for him. He was just a teenager, 19 years old, with the 106th Infantry Division in Europe. He was there when the Battle of the Bulge began 63 years ago today, December 16th, 1944. And for the first 3 days, you're running around, you're taking this ammunition, as you talked about, trying not to get shot while you're running it from one spot to another. And then 3 days into the Battle of the Bulge, December 19th, all of a sudden, they tell you, stop firing.
They said, don't shoot when the Germans come in, and I thought some Germans were surrendering to us.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And then they said, break your weapons. And so I knew then that there was the other way around. But you really can't get a total perspective of what's going on. You only know what you can see and where you are, and when you're in the Schnee Eiffel forest of the Ardennes forest and the Schnee Eiffel mountains, you don't have any broad amount of visibility, and you just it's forest and a lot of trees.
In other words, you knew that you and the men around you, eventually you knew that you were being surrendered. How long did it take before you realized the magnitude of that surrender and how many men were surrendered to the Germans?
Well, after they said don't shoot when the Germans come in, why the German officer gave us instructions to just come out of the forest and into a clearing, and so there were several thousand at that time, and altogether two regiments, about 10,000 men, were surrendered to the Germans because we had very little ammunition left, no food, no water, without much ammunition and.
They felt like they had no choice but to surrender.
Well, it was our officers surrendered us. I mean, I didn't have to make a decision. I was ordered to do it, and some did try to take off into the forest. But one thing they tell you in the military, two things. Number one, don't fall asleep on guard duty, and two, always obey orders. So when they have that pounded into your head, why, you do it.
And it probably saved your life.
Well, that's right.
So I can't imagine what goes through your mind. Here you are, 19 years old. You're over there trying just to stay warm, let alone stay alive. And now all of a sudden, you're a prisoner of this regime that you've heard all these horrible things about that you know is not necessarily a nice regime. What goes through your mind in a situation like that?
Well, we were... our colonels surrendered us to the two regiments of the 106th Division and several thousand others to the regular German army, and at least my own experience was that they treated us like soldiers, and the SS fortunately were to the north of us, so we didn't have to deal with them. It was the regular German army, and they were professional.
As it happened, you came pretty close to running into the SS because the same guys that were involved in the Malmedy massacre passed right by where you were, right?
That's right. That's right. And they were to the north of us, and it's so. But the regular German army, I'll say, was professional. They didn't inflict any indignities on you, and if you didn't give them any trouble, their attitude was that they won't give you any trouble.
So being packed into a 40-8 wasn't an indignity then, huh?
Well, at least we didn't have to walk.
Explain to our listeners, for those who aren't familiar with that.
48 is a World War One type boxcar that is designed for 8 horses and or 40 men. And in this instance, they put about 60 of us in there, really cheek by jowl. So it's but at least the togetherness kept us warmer, and we did have our very good GI wool overcoats.
So here you are packed into these boxcars, and then they transport you to a place called Stalag 9B in Bad Orb, Germany.
Yeah, we were in the boxcar for 4 days, and they did get some water to us on at least one occasion, and then they provided a loaf of bread to be divided between those that were in the boxcar. When you don't have any decision to make because you're in the custody of the enemy, because your officers that made that decision, you just take it as it comes and do your best.
And you just so happened to arrive at this POW camp, Stalag 9B, on?
Christmas Day of 1944. Bad Orb is 37 miles northeast of Frankfurt. It's a beautiful country. It's up in the low mountains, when they opened the boxcars, we hiked a few miles to the camp itself, which was on top of a hill, and it had been a youth camp at one time, and then they turned it into a prison camp when they needed the space.
Now, in about 9 days, you'll be celebrating Christmas with your family here in the relatively warm setting of the valley. At least you'll be inside, too, which is nice. When you get to that day every year, when you celebrate Christmas with your family, do you think about that day 63 years ago?
I think of it all the time. I think some of the family members don't want to hear about it anymore.
Well, if they're listening, we apologize for being redundant.
They've heard too much about it already.
When you got there to Stalag 9B, and I don't know how much you knew at the time about how prisoners were treated in POW camps or anything.
I didn't know anything about how we were going to be treated. We knew that they hadn't shot us, and we had safety in numbers because 2 regiments are 8,000 men, and then they had another 2,000, several thousand from the other divisions, such as the 28th Division, the Keystone Division from Pennsylvania, that was to the north of us. So. You don't know what the future is going to hold for you, but you know that you're still alive.
Did you think that you would still be alive at the end of the war? At that point, were you optimistic that you'd get back home to San Francisco?
When you're 19, you have to be an optimist, and youth has its own optimism, and of course. In the PW camp, we were strafed by an American plane and also bombed by an American plane because they didn't realize it was a PW camp.
They didn't have signs on the top of the building saying...
Well, I think they had a Red Cross on top of it, which should have been... But I think they didn't trust the Germans.
Well, I've heard stories of dirty tricks like pulled. And I imagine there was quite a bit of snow on top of some of those buildings at that point as well.
That's right.
What was life like in that POW camp? Did you feel like you had... Obviously, there were men that you had already been serving with there. But did you guys maybe console each other, take comfort in your common plight there? What was it like? What was the camaraderie like?
Well, we're all in essence in the same boat, and the main thing is that when the Germans gave us the little bit of food that we had, because I lost 35 pounds in 3.5 months, and that would beat Weight Watchers or Jenny Craig. I hope they aren't one of your sponsors.
Not that you would encourage anyone to try a POW diet.
So that's, but...
What kind of food were you given? I'm sure it wasn't exactly tasty.
Well, it's... they had stewed the tops of sugar beets and on every third day we got mush, and the day we were liberated, I had carved a which was April 2nd of 1945, a month before VE Day. I had carved out a wooden spoon, and one of it was a very joyous day. I mean, when an American tank came through the gate of the PW camp, we were just ecstatic. And that was a month before the war ended, and I don't know how we were so fortunate to still be in West Germany rather than having to do what... the others who were captured had to walk halfway across Germany to the Polish border.
We've had a gentleman on this program who had to participate in that German death march all the way across. And, boy, I'm thankful that he's here, just like I'm thankful that you're here. We need to hit another commercial break here, but you make this sound so simple and you're so matter-of-fact in your description. But when we come back, I want to find out more about how you kept going and how you kept your spirits up and persevered through the cold, through the starvation, and through the uncertain future. So we'll visit more with Judge Frank Creed when Hometown Heroes continues on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Since it is December 16th, the 63rd anniversary of the beginning of the Battle of the Bulge, we have a gentleman who was there as our guest today, Judge Frank J. Creed, Jr. I should add the junior on the end. And he felt like a junior in 1944. He was just 19 years old when he was captured by the Germans on December 19th. He was taken to a POW camp, arrived there on Christmas Day, not the present he was asking for, and not exactly the menu that he had hoped to sample either in the POW camp at Stalag 9B. But I understand that one of the things that kept your mind occupied and kept you focused on your eventual goal of getting back home was remembering some of the great restaurants that you wanted to eat at when you got back home. That sounds like almost torture when you're in this kind of situation.
Well, all of us came from different cities across the country, and we would prepare lists of the recommended restaurants that we would suggest to any of us who were in that city, and that kept us occupied, thinking about food all the time.
And the food that you certainly didn't have, you described some of it for us, the stewed tops of sugar beets and mush if you're lucky, and 750 calories a day, losing 32 pounds in 3.5 months in your time there. What were some of the other things that you wrote down? Because I know when I visited with you for the TV story that we worked on together, you showed me some of the lists. You showed me the lists of restaurants still written on that German scratch paper in pencil.
And if you look on the back of the paper, it's printed in German.
That's right.
So, because that was the only paper that was available to us, they didn't hand out any stationery.
You also wrote down, I think at the time, rumors of things that you heard were going to happen, and How much contact did you have with the outside world? Were you able to tune in some BBC broadcasts and hear some radio updates?
Well, they had each PW camp had a, what they called a man of confidence, someone who would communicate any instructions from the Germans to the various groups, and so that they told us what the news the German media had provided to the German people, and you could read between the lines, and so for example, if they said they were fighting in Budapest, and then they didn't talk about Budapest anymore, you knew that the Russians had taken Budapest, and the same thing was true of other news items. But at least we did have access through the POW network to the general progress of the war, and you could pretty well tell when they stopped talking about a particular location that the Germans had lost it, and then within the month before we were liberated, you could tell from the artillery that was initially coming from the west, and when that was German artillery, and then when it progressed to where it was coming from the north and south, and then from the east, well, you knew that this was on the Western Front.
You knew somebody was going to show up. You just hoped it was the right guys, right?
That's right. So,
what was that moment like? And you talked about the utensils that you carved. And if anyone wants to see those utensils, they can see them in downtown Fresno at the Veterans Memorial Museum, a wonderful place. If you've never been there, it's free admission. It's open from 10 to 3, Monday through Saturday. Art Hill and all the volunteers down there do a wonderful job. And there's a very nice display in the POW room of Judge Creed's utensils, and also a picture of Stalag 9B in Bad Orb. We talked about that. We talked about what you went through as far as your ideal diet for losing weight, 32 pounds in 3.5 months. What was that moment like, though, on April 2nd, 1945? What do you remember seeing and experiencing?
Well, first of all, we knew it was coming because you, the sounds of the artillery moved from the west to the north and south, and then to the east, you knew that the Allied armies were penetrating to that point, and then there was an increase in fighter plane activity. American, fortunately, we were strafed by a German plane when we were on before we were surrendered. But it was, we could...
Do you remember seeing a tank come through the gate? What was the signature moment of that liberation?
Well, we could tell by the progress of the artillery, and then we heard small arms fire,
mm-hmm.
and that told you that the time of... liberation was probably at hand. And then at 9 o'clock in the morning on April 2nd, the day after Easter in 1944,
So you get to the camp on Christmas Day,
the
day after Easter.
The day after Easter was the day of liberation. And so we were just ecstatic when we saw an American tracked vehicle just go right through the barbed wire. And then we found out they had no food for us because the frontline troops just have barely enough for themselves. I mean, there's no, they don't carry extra rations for POWs, and so they it took them several days to get sea rations to us, and then the food was so rich from the sea rations that we all got quite sick.
Well, your stomachs hadn't been used to anything
that's
of
right.
substance
that's
for
that's
3.5 months.
That's right.
And I've heard that story that pretty much in the same terms from just about every POW that
sure.
I've talked to, that you get so excited to have real food for a change that your eyes are bigger than your stomach, literally.
Sure. When after they flew us back to Camp Lucky Strike at in France,
mm-hmm.
There was one fellow who I think died because he ate so many donuts.
Oh, my goodness. How do you tell that story to his family?
Well, that's I didn't have the responsibility.
Thank goodness.
Of breaking the news to his family.
Were you surprised at all when that all happened? Did it seem at all too good to be true? Maybe this isn't really over yet, or did you feel like this was it? You were finally free again, and everything was going to be okay.
On the day of liberation, I knew everything was going to be okay, and that for us then the war was really over, because one of the things the Germans used to say when they would capture somebody, for you the war is over, and you're not sure whether they're going to shoot you or take you to beat up your camp. But in any event, there were so many of us, two regiments, more Americans that were surrendered by our colonels to the enemy in WW2, except at Bataan and Corregidor. So I take no pride in that, but you know, I was a private in a machine gun squad, and I followed orders, and that's what you're supposed to do. And you let the smart people, the officers who didn't evaluate the intelligence accurately, and let the Germans get so many troops and tanks in one...
250,000 men and 2,000 pieces of artillery that nobody knew.
That's right.
Were sitting there waiting on December 16th.
Well, they were very skillful when the way they did this. Hitler, I understand, had ordered that they engage in no radio communications on their side, and that any communications between various armies or units had to be hand-to-hand by written written courier or messenger.
And that secrecy worked. It was a surprise to the Americans, at least as far as we know. Whether it should have been or not is a different question. And for a while, it looked like it might pay off for him, but we all know the end of the story. And one of the elements of that was General Patton rushing to the rescue with the Third Army and trying to help there. And I know that you guys had a song about that in the POW camp, didn't you?
Come and get us, Georgie Patton.
Well, in a minute, I want to read you some orders that he actually wrote. One of the veterans that I visited with last week shared this with me. But before I get to that, I do want to touch briefly with you. We've talked about some of the things you went through, but you haven't brought up, and I don't know if it's difficult to talk about, but you are a Purple Heart recipient. You're very proud of that. And you do have lingering effects of what happened to you 63 years ago. Share with our listeners whatever you feel comfortable with sharing the effects that your captivity had on you.
Well, I got the Purple Heart for frozen feet, which was because there was an order that gave the poor Purple Heart to those who were prisoners of war and therefore couldn't avoid the consequences
You couldn't choose not to march where they told you to march?
Exactly.
Not to ride in the 48th? Sure.
That's right. And so And that's the justification. You know, I would not have really put in for the Purple Heart, but I knew that I got a copy of the order that said I was entitled to it, as were all POWs who were prisoners of war. But it also meant five additional points that would get me back to Stanford.
That was worth it alone, right there.
That's right, and so that the five additional points would got me out in December 1945, rather than 6 or 8 months or 9 months later.
The frozen feet, is that something that has affected you since the war?
Just on my left side, and I have 50% disability for that. It's just surprisingly on the left side. It isn't in the left foot. It isn't bilateral.
Well, I think I can speak for the listening audience when I say that you're certainly deserving of that Purple Heart, and those of us who did not go through what you went through are very thankful for what you've done for our country. There are a few more things that I want to touch on with you, and I will share that letter from General Patton. Right now, we need to hit our final break. When we come back, we'll wrap up the show with Judge Frank J. Creed, Jr., Battle of the Bulge survivor on the 63rd anniversary of the start of that brutal battle in Europe. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. As we come down the home stretch of this program, we'll be back with you again next Sunday from 4 to 5 as well as we get closer and closer to Christmas. I hope that you have a wonderful holiday with your family and that it's more enjoyable than Christmas 1944 was for Frank Creed as he arrived at Stalag 9B that day. I mentioned these orders from General Patton. In fact, I was going to read them last week, but ran out of time. The veteran that I featured on CBS 47 last week, Bob Ha, had a copy of these orders because he was attached to the 3rd Army at the time. And this was sent in the middle of the Battle of the Bulge. Frank Creed had already been captured for about 2 weeks, and you heard him talk about the song they used to sing. Instead of Glory, Glory, Hallelujah, it was Come and Save Us, Georgie Patton, to the tune of the Battle Hymn of the Republic. But these are the words on paper, the orders from General George S. Patton, Jr. on January 1st, 1945, 2 weeks into the Battle of the Bulge. And he writes, "From the bloody corridor at Avranches to Brest, thence across France to the Saar, over the Saar into Germany, and now on to Bastogne, your record has been one of continuous victory. Not only have you invariably defeated a cunning and ruthless enemy, but also you have overcome by your indomitable fortitude every aspect of terrain and weather." That was some significant terrain and weather. "Neither heat nor dust nor floods nor snow have stayed your progress. The speed and brilliancy of your achievements is unsurpassed in military history." And he goes on to write, "My New Year wish and sure conviction for you is that under the protection of Almighty God and the inspired leadership of our President and the High Command, you will continue your victorious course to the end, that tyranny and vice shall be eliminated, our dead comrades avenged, and peace restored to a war-weary world. In closing, I can find no fitter expression for my feelings than to apply to you the immortal words spoken by General Scott at Chapultepec when he said, 'Brave soldiers, veterans, you have been baptized in fire and blood and have come out steel.'" So that was the way General Patton thought he could encourage the men of the 3rd Army. And I guess you're thankful that he encouraged them that way because they had a hand in your eventual rescue and liberation.
Well, yes, indeed. And the interesting thing is that General Patton was the superior of General Bradley, but the slapping incident in Sicily, they had taken him out of the out of command at that time, and then I think that personally, I think that if that had not occurred, the war would have been over faster because I think Patton was.
He wouldn't have messed around. Although, of course, they have said about him as well. And my grandfather was at the Battle of the Bulge and actually met Patton once, took a picture of him. But he said in their unit, they used to always refer to him not as old blood and guts, but if they did, they'd say, his guts, our blood.
That's, well, of course.
So, there are those two sides of General Patton. But I thought that was very inspiring, just for me to read now, 60 years later, to put myself in those shoes of a soldier who's hearing these orders. And I think that would be inspiring. That would mean something to you.
Why, certainly. And one thing, particularly coming from General Patton, because he was well known for being up in the front lines where some of the American other American generals were living in relative comfort some distance back from the front lines.
But now, I want to ask you about one more thing before we get to the end of the show, and I do, before we close, I want to say a special thank you to the folks from the Stories of Service Project. I know that you've been involved with them, and you're featured in the book that they put out, Stories of Service, Valley Veterans Remember World War II.
Janice Stevens did a very good job.
She did a fabulous job
putting that book together.
And today, before I came over here, I was at my day job at Channel 47, and I got a visit from a veteran named Bill Bohegan and a young lady named Nora Walker, who's a high school student who's working on veteran stories through Stories of Service. And they presented me with a copy of that book signed by a bunch of veterans. And I very much appreciate that gesture. They've enjoyed the TV series. I hope they're enjoying Hometown Heroes, and that was a very nice gesture and made my day. So I want to thank them before I forget about that. And now I want to talk to you about when you came back across the Atlantic Ocean. Here, you're finally free. You're no longer a prisoner of war. And as you sail into New York Harbor, I understand that you had an emotional moment.
Oh, indeed. Being just 19, you know, I didn't have the occasion to have a tear in my eye, either in the combat, in the PW camp, and so forth. But when I just thinking about it, brings the memory of the Statue of Liberty as the ship went into New York Harbor, and I couldn't hold back the tears at that time, and that was the only time I cried during the war. Going back, I didn't know my future wife was going to be from New York at that time. She's sitting right here.
Had you known, there might have been an extra tear coming down, or maybe a bigger smile.
No. She's a New Yorker, and I was from San Francisco. So in any event, it's... That's a very clear memory.
Did that, when you saw that statue, did that mean to you that this is what we were fighting for?
Absolutely.
This is why I was in the POW camp?
Absolutely. It stood for everything that the swastika did not stand for. And to an American, it is very, very meaningful and should be given appropriate reverence by all Americans.
Well, and it's very clear that you still hold that reverence for it. And
absolutely.
And that's a great example to set for our young people today. I mentioned that Stories of Service project, and the Center for Multicultural Cooperation here in town is the biggest sponsor of those efforts to match up young people with World War II veterans, and they learn the history. They also learn how to put it into a little movie. It's a very rewarding project, and those are the people that I was talking about a moment ago. I know that you've been involved with some of them, and you've been in Janice's class in Clovis, and I would encourage anyone who has a teenager, if you're trying to find something for your teenager to do, get them involved. It's a great way to learn history and to learn skills that will help your teenager in the future for sure. Well, Your Honor, if I can call you that, thank you so much for being with me today. Thank you for your service to our country overseas and back at home after you got home. And it's very fitting that your bus is in downtown Fresno, because you've left quite a legacy here in the Valley and you continue to inspire the people who know you. So thank you.
Thank you, Paul, for allowing me to be on the program. And the one thing I certainly learned is you never judge people by superficial values, which has helped me throughout my career and my occupation. And I think that more of us can profit from that, because we do tend to sometimes judge people by superficial values, because you don't know who the heroes are. You don't know the one who's going to lay down their life for you until you're tested.
And, that's right.
You undoubtedly have many of them on the program who will attest to that.
Amen to that. Well, we are out of time for this Sunday. We thank you so much for listening. Hope you'll join us again next Sunday as we talk a little bit more about Christmas. I don't know if it'll be as crazy a Christmas as it was for Frank Creed in 1944. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.